Bob Woodward, you've spent months up close to the president as he worked his way through a tough decision on a war. From what you've seen, what sort of commander-in-chief is Barack Obama?
He's very cerebral, quite smart, looks at the Afghan war in particular, reads the intelligence reports, the military analysis, and realizes that it's not going very well. Given that, he's quite restrained. And he's gone ahead and escalated, added 30,000 troops, but at all the top secret meetings, he will say and emphasize, I want a plan to hand it over to the Afghans, to hand over security to them, and for the United States to get its combat forces out. And he insists there can be no wiggle room in this.
Yes, he asked for options on Afghanistan from the military command, and he didn't get them. What does that say about his authority?
Well, it raises that question. He persisted. He said, you promised to give me three options here, and you're only essentially giving me one. And the military said, yes, sir, we think that's the only right way. Now, the president is supposed to get a window into the world of choice through his top military advisors. If he says, I want choice, they should give it to him. And in this case, they did not. So he had to design his own option and his own strategy, which is what he did.
Why didn't they? Is there a disrespect there?
What there is conviction. They are sure they're right. This is the way to do it. Particularly General Petraeus, who's the author of the counterinsurgency strategy. It takes a lot of time, takes a lot of money. The president doesn't think it will work and has shortened the timelines and only gave the military 30,000 troops where they had requested 40,000.
Now, you document this rift between the military leadership and Obama. You also, though, say that it's likely to persist. How dangerous is that?
It's not the way it should be. And you ask the right question. What is his authority? He should be able to say to the military, look, I want to do it this way. Give me some choice. And that has not happened. The generals have said, despite the president's orders, where he says he's going to start withdrawing troops next July, the military has said, well, if we show progress, we can get more time on the clock. But here they are kind of stiffing the president again. Why is the military acting this way? As I said, they believe it. The second reason is something called Vietnam. It's theme music in the background of all of these discussions. Military remembers the books called Dereliction of Duty, where the Joint Chiefs and the military was not forceful enough with the president. So, as we often find out in this country, the Vietnam War and its legacy is not over.
So, on Afghanistan, Obama ended up drawing up his own plan, committing 30,000 troops rather than 40,000. Who do you think won that Afghanistan skirmish?
On one level, some of the generals say they kind of rolled the president. They got enough to do what they think is necessary, and I print in the back of the book 6 pages of secret orders that he issued to the military trying to limit the mission. Some of the generals say, that's just verbiage. We're on the ground. We're running the war. On the other hand, some people think that the president was tough with the military and made it clear they have a limited time to conduct and show some success in this war.
Did you ever see him get really angry during this discussion process?
I did not see him, but I reported from notes. I mean, he literally blew up a number of times. He blew up at the Secretary of Defense and said, look, I've decided on 30,000, and the Secretary of Defense was pushing him, and the president just said, look, I've decided on 30,000. That is it. What's interesting, the military kept pushing back and trying to change things, and the president was quite upset about it and kept then personally dictating these secret orders to limit what the uniformed military might do on the ground.
Is this an unusually troubled relationship between a president and his military leaders?
I think it's in the DNA of both. What is interesting and significant. The president hasn't established personal relations with these military leaders, so they can really work together. There is a kind of schism, and in a very real sense, it's his leadership responsibility to get these things settled, and they are not settled.
Did it surprise you that a president known as a great communicator wasn't able to develop a better relationship, that he developed, in fact, such a fractious relationship so early?
It's not a communication problem, you know, it's about who you're going to trust and where you're going to get your advice, and it turns out that there's a small group in the White House who deal with all of the problems, and there is a kind of distance that the military people feel, and there's a kind of distance that the president practices.
Well, the General McChrystal dismissal, you foreshadowed the tensions between him and the Obama team, but were you shocked at those comments that he and his staff made that led to his dismissal?
Well, they're kind of mild compared to some of the things I've got in this book, like the National Security Advisor, General Jones, calling the members of the president's political staff water bugs who flit around, the mafia, the campaign set.
Well, we now have General Petraeus in charge in Afghanistan. How would you describe the relationship now between President Obama and General Petraeus, who essentially took a demotion to take over in Afghanistan?
There's been a tension between the White House and General Petraeus. I cite examples in which Petraeus feels they're effing with the wrong guy when they kind of push back. There's a scene in the book in which General Petraeus says to Rahm Emanuel, "I can be your lead sled dog here." And Emanuel says, "Yeah, yeah, yeah," but they never bring Petraeus in as any kind of sled dog, let alone the lead sled dog.
So how much of a problem is that?
Well, I think personal relations matter, and the president has got to spend time developing those. This is not simply an intellectual exercise of reading reports and having debates. It is sometimes you have to sit down and have a beer with your generals.
Well, Rahm Emanuel, the president's chief of staff, was antagonistic, but he's now leaving. How do you think his departure will change the Obama White House?
The answer is we don't know. It's a political White House. It always is, going back to coverage of the Nixon administration.
Now, there are reports today of Taliban leaders negotiating with the Karzai government. So could President Obama ultimately see his strategy working and giving him the opportunity to start his mid-2011 withdrawal?
Yeah, exactly. My paper, The Washington Post, has this report. Very preliminary discussions. In the book, I show that number of people in the White House have discussions about the secret intelligence reports coming in that show that the Taliban leadership is not happy because they've been under the thumb of the Pakistani intelligence service, and they're kind of saying, hey, wait a minute, maybe we need to negotiate something. And of course, the way out of this war is some sort of negotiated diplomatic settlement, and you're seeing some baby steps in that direction.
Let me just ask you about Pakistan, because President Obama made it clear that he sees Pakistan as the real foreign policy concern. Now, this was even before the flood disaster. From what you know of his approach, how do you think he'll deal with Pakistan?
At these top secret meetings, he does, as you say, identify Pakistan as the cancer. And because of these safe havens, not only for Al-Qaeda, but some of these Pakistani groups, terrorist groups in Pakistan, I would say, is the powder keg of South Asia.
So what do you think that President Obama's approach would be, for example, had the Times Square bomber actually been successful?
A Pakistani who, it turns out, the intelligence shows was trained and supported by one of these Pakistani terrorist groups. I report in detail how the CIA director, Leon Panetta, went to Pakistan and said if this had gone off, the president would have had no choice but to do some things that you're going to hate. It was only dumb luck that the bomb did not go off. And General Jones, the National Security Advisor, CIA director Panetta, did not mince words in secret meetings with the Pakistanis in May and said, look, if this happens, the president will almost have no choice. He's going to have to do something because there has not been a terrorist attack in the United States since 9/11.
So you've described someone prepared to be aggressive towards Pakistan but very keen to get out of Afghanistan. Do you think that President Obama would countenance a military strike against Iran?
I don't know the answer to that, and it would depend on the circumstances. It looks like Iran has experienced some setbacks in their efforts to develop nuclear weapons, but I'm not up to speed on the latest information on that.
Do you think, though, from what you've seen of the way that President Obama conducted himself with the military, that he would countenance something as aggressive as a military strike?
There would really have to be special circumstances. One of the findings in my discussion with the president, reviewing the whole history of the 18 months, is President Obama does not like war. Now, I know no American president who likes war, but Obama really dislikes war. And he said to me that once you unleash the dogs of war, you lose control. And he said he views his job as imposing some order on the chaos of war. So I think he would be about as a reluctant warrior could be to go to war in Iran. Now, if the Iranians attacked or developed a nuclear weapon and used it someplace like in Israel, maybe there would, again, be no choice. But in terms of the internal Barack Obama, he's not a pacifist. Clearly, he's willing to escalate the war, but he doesn't see war as leading to particularly stable or fruitful settlements.
Bob Woodward, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.